like Chicago and New York City. Reports indicate that ICE is planning another round of raids in Aurora, Colorado on Thursday, with three additional cities expected to be targeted next week. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is appearing before the Senate Finance Committee today during his first of two confirmation hearings. Calling him a predator who is addicted to power, Carolyn Kennedy, daughter of President John F. Kennedy, urged the U.S. Senate in a Tuesday letter to reject the nomination of her cousin to be President Donald Trump's health secretary. Nathan Elgren has more.
Carolyn Kennedy has broken her silence on the nomination of her cousin, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., to be the nation's next top health official. In a public letter addressed to U.S. senators, Kennedy called her cousin a, quote, predator who's addicted to power.
Bobby has gone on to misrepresent, lie, and cheat his way through life. While he may encourage a younger generation to attend AA meetings, Bobby is addicted to attention and power. Bobby preys on the desperation of parents of sick children, vaccinating his own kids while building a following, hypocritically discouraging other parents from vaccinating theirs.
Robert F. Kennedy is facing some skepticism from the public. A survey from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research shows only about 3 in 10 Americans approve of President Donald Trump nominating Kennedy as Department of Health and Human Services Secretary. The White House has announced a plan to offer all 2.3 million federal workers 8 months of salary and benefits in exchange for their resignation. Labor unions have strongly condemned the move, calling it an unprecedented violation of laws governing buyout payments. The American Federation of Government Employees, which represents over 800,000 federal workers in Washington, D.C., criticized the plan, accusing the Trump administration of attempting to create chaos. For Pacifica Radio, I'm Teresa Wierzbianska.
Welcome to Africa Now! Today's show features Reflections on Autonomy, Direct Democracy, and Maroonage with Modibo Kadale, Part 4, and update on the situation in Goma, DRC. Africa Now is next! Welcome to the show, I'm Moise Muntali. The music in the background is Tres Empoli by Franco and TPOK Jazz. The show begins with an update on the attack on the city of Goma in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, by Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. Featured in the conversation is Congolese journalist Akilimali Chomachoma and Niles Kinwani, board director and immigration coordinator for the Congolese community of Washington Metropolitan, that's CCWM. The recording of Akilimali Chomachoma is courtesy of Friends of the Congo. Here is the conversation. Niles Kinwani, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Mwiza, happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. And also, I know you're dealing with a lot with the situation back home in Congo. The situation in Goma in particular. Yeah. And we wanted to get your viewpoints, particularly as it pertains to what people here from Congo and the Congolese diaspora are doing, and also the information they're getting from people on the ground. I wanted to start with a recording, which we got courtesy of Friends of the Congo, of a reporter, a media person, who is in Congo, in Goma. And we've had him on the show as Akilimali Chomachoma, but unfortunately, as people can understand, it's very hard to, you can't get a hold of people right now in the current situation. So somebody recorded him from Kinshasa and forwarded this information to us. So we'll start with that conversation. giving us what the present situation is on the ground in the DRC, in Goma. This is as of the 28th, Tuesday the 28th, January 28th, 2025. And here is Akilimali Choma Choma.
Resistance of Fakistan was planned, but it seems like the N23, they just crossed my road right now, like 20 minutes ago. And it seems like they have more troops and they are taking avenue by avenue.
It's not really, it's not easy.
Yes, it's not easy, but right now it seems quite good compared to yesterday.
But the airport is still under the control of the FRDC, our army, I think.
No, the fact that the Congolese army lost the airport, like we have like 2 hours around 10 a.m. local time of Goma, they lost it. And right now, it's under control of
Rodriguez, thank you for the information. Just keep in touch. I'll be calling you.
thank you so much.
Yeah, be safe, please. Don't move.
Okay. I will not move for sure. It's not the time. To move this time.
Yeah. Thank you, brother. I will report to Brother Maurice and the team. Yeah. Well, okay.
Thank you so much. We are okay here. We are in the dark, without electricity, without network, without water, but we are still here.
Yeah, we're sharing the same feeling here. We're together, brother. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Niles, you heard that conversation with Akilimali Choma Choma, who is in Goma, about what they're going through. I wonder if you could add any more to that.
Yes, so the situation on the ground is volatile and it's developing very quickly. But as Akilimali reported, we are learning that the M23 rebels and essentially the Rwandan army are controlling a big part of the city now, in Goma. So we're also learning that the Congolese army is trying to resist, but you know, the rebels are there and they're controlling a major part of the city right now.
And do you have a percentage of the amount of area that the M23 is controlling and also the Congolese forces are controlling?
As of yesterday, last night, the Congolese army was controlling, I think, 60 to 80% of the city, the area, and the rebels were controlling about 20 to 30%. But again, that number, you know, might shift, change any time. And we actually also learned this morning that the M23s are advancing very quickly to the airport. And I should note here that the Goma airport was a central area in this attack. But we're learning that the M23s are essentially controlling the airport in Goma. So that's another development to note here.
Yeah, and that's also what Akilimali was saying in that conversation we just heard, that the M23 just controlled the airport like early morning at 10 a.m. or something, which would be Congolese time, which they're about 6 hours ahead from here. So that's what, and as you mentioned, that's a key area because that's where also a lot of the UN planes take off from for relief efforts and all that in the area. And talking about the UN, we've heard about the killings of UN peacekeeping forces. There were 13 peacekeepers who were killed. Nine were from South Africa, three were from Malawi, and then one from Uruguay. What is the feeling on the ground of the UN peacekeeper forces? Well, they split because there is the UN peacekeeping force, but there's also the other Southern African keeping force, which the Malawi and the South Africans were part of, which were seen, they were seen to have better relations with the Congolese government and forces.
Yeah, so there has been reinforcement from Malawi and South African forces, army forces, but that support is not making a big difference on the ground, because we're seeing that the M23s, the Rwandan forces, are advancing very quickly. So we'll see how long they can stay, how long they can help, but for now, their support on the ground is not making a big difference.
And again, that is Niles Kiwani, and he is on the board of director of the and also immigration coordinator for the Congolese Community of Washington Metropolitan CCWM, and we're looking at the situation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, particularly in Goma, where the M23 have gone in and are fighting the Congolese forces. And the UN has talked, the especially the Secretary General has talked about how Rwanda should leave, and clearly have issued many reports before this about the backing of Rwanda. And then we've seen also demonstrations, sorry, backing of Rwanda of the M23, and we've also seen the demonstrations in Kinshasa at embassies and which the Congolese see as being implicated in the attack on their country. If you could elaborate on that, what you're hearing from people of what is what the Congolese are saying and doing, particularly as it pertains to the international role in this issue.
Yeah, so I think what Congolese people are expressing now is essentially their frustration, right? Frustration on the international community, right? So the DRC has been demanding sanctions against Rwanda because essentially, as you mentioned, and everybody should know at this point, that Rwanda is supporting, backing the M23 rebels, right? And the most recent report from the UN is showing that Rwandan forces, soldiers are actually on the ground. In Goma, there are about 3 to 4 thousand of Rwandan soldiers now in the DRC, but they've been there for a while now, and so we and that's clear. That's a clear invasion of the on the Congolese soil territory, right? That's a clear violation of the DRC territorial integrity, right? And that's something that, as I mentioned, has been established by multiple reports from the UN and other organizations. And so based on that, we the DRC government and the Congolese people, we've been demanding sanctions against Rwanda. It's something that we have been able to get for several years, right? And now this is just a stepping stone to Rwanda's war agenda against the DRC. We've seen statements from the international community condemning Rwanda, but I think those statements, those words without any action are just meaningless. So now we are pressing on the international community to impose sanctions on Rwanda because if Rwanda is committing aggression and violating the territorial integrity and the sovereignty of the DRC, then there should be consequences under international law.
And also, what other actions is the diaspora doing, particularly this week, but and beyond?
So I'm not going to be able to share much at this point, but we are organizing ourselves, and the same the same way Congolese people around the world are concerned. We also here are very concerned, very worried about the situation on the ground. Some of us here have lost family members in crossfire in Goma, and so we are very concerned. We are organizing ourselves. There will be action. We'll take action, and so we are preparing for those actions that we will take, whether it's a rally, it's a petition that we're sending to the institutions here in DC, in Washington DC, all around, in the other countries where there's Congolese diaspora represented. But we are for now organizing ourselves and preparing any action that we can take to make sure that the voices of our Congolese brothers and sisters are heard, especially those who are victims of this war in Eastern DRC.
Is there a specific rally that you're talking about in the Washington metropolitan area that's taking place?
We're still preparing, planning. At this point, we are organizing ourselves. We, getting together, and more details will be shared in the coming days.
What is the website of the Congolese community of Washington Metropolitan?
At ccwm.org. Also, I would like to note here that Friends of Congo would also be a good resource for people seeking information about the situation on the ground and any organizing efforts for the Congolese diaspora and other concerned U.S. citizens that will want to help Congolese people raise make their voices heard.
Do you have any other closing thoughts and comments, statements for people here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area and beyond?
So we are asking people, this is a matter of humanity. I should remind your listeners that the conflict in the DRC, or I should say the war of aggression that Rwanda is pursuing against the DRC is the deadliest armed conflict since World War II. Over 6 million people killed, 7 million displaced. So this is really about humanity, right? And so we are asking everybody to stand with the people of Congo and help us end this cycle of violence. So anything that we can do, we are asking anything that people can do. We are asking people to raise awareness about the situation, whether on social media or with the U.S. government here, with your elected officials. If you're in a one way to support would be to raise awareness and share what's happening in the DRC so that everybody can know and that Rwanda's action in the DRC should be known by everybody and should lead to consequences.
Niles Kinwani, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Mwiza.
You just heard a conversation I had yesterday with Niles Kinwani. He's on the board of directors and immigration coordinator for the Congolese Community of Washington Metropolitan, CCWM. And earlier on, you heard Congolese journalist Akilimali Choma Choma, who is in Goma. That was an update on the attack on the city of Goma in the Democratic Republic of the Congo by Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. We'll have extensive coverage on this situation in upcoming shows. The music in the background is Almina by Kofi. Now, following up from our show last week, today you listen to part 4 of a 4-part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, maroonage, black anarchism, and atheism with Modibo Kadale. Dr. Modibo Kadale is a social ecologist, academic, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, black power, and pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. He is the author of Pan-African Social Ecology, Speeches, Conversations, and Essays, Internationalism, Pan-Africanism, and the Struggle for Social Classes, Intimate Direct Democracy, Fort Mosi, The Great Dismal Swamp, and The Human Quest for Freedom, and a number of other articles. Here is Dr. Modibo Kadale and African Owl's executive producer and co-host, James Pope.
Thank you for taking the time to join us today. And the intellectual breadth of your work is very important, particularly in this time. Not that it wasn't important before. You know, sometimes ideas don't catch on until the moment allows them to kind of come to fruition. Let's jump right into a conversation. Thank you, Brother Modibo, for taking the time to just join in the conversation. The intention is for it to be useful for those who engage it, to kind of follow a historical genealogy. And the platform is yours. I'm just going to be sitting in the car with you. You driving. I'm on the passenger side. I'll be prompting certain questions. So let's go ahead and get started. Again, thank you for joining us today. So let's go to the autobiographical sketch. Okay, let's start there and then we'll move.
Yeah, it's always challenging to figure out when did you become conscious and deliberate, you know. And it's always, I always look at the sit-ins in 1960, March of 1960 in Atlanta. But in reflection, I'm thinking it must be earlier than that, because the sit-ins jumped off in 1959. 1960 is when the sit-in jumped off. I'm not sure I understood what that was all about. Because where I come from, black people voted. There was some segregation in the county seat, but I grew up in a black community. And these people were doing, democratically deciding what they were doing and where they were going to go. And they had the Emancipation Proclamation parade back in the woods, you know, all kind of things that was residual. But I think that the time when I really got to understand this direct democracy stuff is when I was on the swimming team in 1962. I had come up from Riceboro when I was 16, and I could swim, you know, but I wasn't I had no competitive swimming experience. I taught myself how to swim. When I realized that I was really didn't like authoritarianism at all, is when in 1962, the fall of 1962, I had been swimming for a while. How I got into swimming was I wanted to play football, and I'm so glad I didn't get into that. Because I was 152, 153 pounds when I went to Morehouse. And I was going to go out for the football team. We had just started a football team down here. And I was going to be the quarterback, but came to Morehouse before that took place. So I had visions in my head that I was going to go out for backup quarterback at Morehouse and stuff. So I went down to the locker room at the gym, and I got my stuff and was going to put my stuff on and go out on the field. But I saw them guys in the locker room, high school football, different college football, even at the lowest level. And man, I saw some guys weighing about 300 pounds And they were freshmen. They said the real team hadn't even come back yet. So I made a decision that maybe I shouldn't do that. So I put my gear back into the supply place, and the guy laughed at me and said, "Oh, you're not going out." I said, "I don't think I'm going to do this." So that same night, it was a Wednesday, I went, they had recreational swimming at Morehouse. I went down to the swimming pool just to enjoy myself, splash around a little bit, you know, because I enjoyed swimming, the swimming in creeks and ditches and stuff. So this guy called me over and said, "Son, swim right over there for me." Old guy, old big tall guy. I later found out that was Dr. Haynes. I swam across. I did my best imitation of Tarzan. Swam across the pool and swam back. He said, the guy told me, he said, "Look, we got a swim team in Morehouse." I said, "You got a swim team? Well, what do y'all do?" He said, "We swim." I said, "Well, when y'all, he said, "Would you meet me down here Monday at 1 o'clock? And we'll see if you can't help us out." So he was there. Wasn't nobody in there but me and him. And he put me through a few routines and stuff. And it was hard, man. It was really hard. I mean, I was hard, sore, and everything. So at the end of that week, he said, "Now, if you want to join the swim team, we practice at 4 o'clock Monday." By that time, I was disenchanted. I said, "Oh, okay, I don't want to go home. I want to see him no more," because he was putting me through some torture, man. So I came down there. I was going back and forth about the decision. So I came down there at 4 o'clock, and these guys were swimming. I mean, they were really swimming, man. And he said, I asked him, I said, "Man, you think I can help you out?" He said, "Yeah, you're going to be able to help us out." And so he had a little thing, a little clipboard and a little training schedule. And I made the team. And I found out it was a championship team. And we were SIAC champ because, I didn't do much the first year. But I realized that if you work hard and progress, you know, you'll make it. In the second year, shoot, man, the second year I was on the relay team, man. You know, we were swimming up a storm. And then I reflected on where I was when I caught the train in Savannah trying to go to Morehouse that previous year. I'd gone miles. I mean, from September to the SIAC swim meet in February, man, I was a different guy, you know? And I look in the mirror, kind of like the ugly duckling, you know what I mean? All my hormones had kicked in. And I said, "What happened up here?" I used to be asthmatic. I was no more asthmatic. And so I got a job at a lifeguard that summer. I worked real hard. And the next year, man, shoot, I was the third guy on the championship relay team. So, but the point I'm getting at is this Coach Haynes, he would get us together and he would say things like, "All right, we swim in Tuskegee today. I've done the research and this is what it looks like to me. But," he said, "I'm not going to get wet. What do y'all think?" And then we raised our hand and said, "Well, we'll if so-and-so would move over here, I think we can score over here. And I think it's going." He said, "All right, we'll do that." Okay, now this same guy here was the coach my freshman year and my sophomore year. With the junior year, he went to Africa and he was coaching some Nigerian team over there. And an authoritarian guy who didn't know swimming became the coach. He hadn't done no research. He didn't know who was who or what was what. And I remember this particular instance, we were swimming Tennessee State. Wilma Rudolph was in the place. And we were looking bad, man. I had been working hard that summer. This is the second, so I worked real hard. And the Tennessee State guy could beat me. I knew he could beat me. But I wanted to be close to him because he was the baddest and the bladdest black butterfly guy in the country. And I swam with him and I stayed with him almost all the way. Then I realized that I could actually rewrite some records. You know what I mean? Because I'd worked real hard and I could go into the record book. So these guys, it was a coach and an assistant coach. they were up to no good. They had the turning point was this guy had ordered the relay team, and it's almost like he was working for Tennessee State. We had four guys on the relay team, and it was a short course pool, so each 100 yards was five laps. So he split it up, first and third was on one end, and the second and fourth was on the other end. So he's organized us in exactly the wrong way. Let me tell you who these guys were. One guy was from Detroit named Carl Holsey. He was an emotional guy, and he was very inconsistent. But if he was in the middle of a race, he gets very excited, you know, and he put forth his best effort because he feeds off of the momentum of the crowd. Then there was another guy named Clayton Cross. Clayton Cross would swim his 57, 58. That's the minute he swam, no matter where he was placed. Then there was another guy. He was from Albany, Georgia. Then it was Bob Harris. Bob Harris could swim. He was good. But if he was behind, he wasn't going to catch nobody. I mean, these guys, that's what their psychological makeup. He wasn't going to catch nobody. But if he was ahead, wasn't nobody going to catch him. Then it was me. I was an emotional guy, too. But if you brought me a lead, or it brought me a piece of a lead, or, you know, I was kind of like a little bit behind, I would put out something. So the guy had it arranged all wrong. He had Carl Holsey swimming in the first lap. He didn't belong in the first leg. He didn't belong there. Clayton Cross needed to belong there. And anyway, I asked the coach, I said, well, shouldn't Clayton Cross be swimming in the first leg? He said, no, I'm the coach. You're the swimmer. You do what I say. You know what I mean? We got in the huddle, and I just said, man, look, we're losing this, and it's looking bad for us. Plus, Wilma Rudolph is in the stand. I'm not going out like this. So, by the way, I was captain of the team by then. So I said, Cross, you swim the first leg. Cross is right on, man. Well, he didn't say right on. He said, hey, I'm ready to go. Jose, you swim the second leg. Because I figured Jose would, if Cross was with the guy, it would become more emotional for him. And I was swimming the third leg. And I figured I could give Bob Harris something to work with. And he was the anchor. See, Coach had me as the anchor. Well, anyway, you know about it. You're an athletic guy.
Yeah, I play basketball, so yeah, I'm very familiar.
You know how that coaches.
Yeah. One of the things we would always say in basketball, you got to know your personnel. Like you got to know who can shoot. You know who can you can get the ball to as they're running down the court. You know, everybody has their particular. Yeah,
and you probably been with some authoritarian coaches too. Anyway. Clayton, it turned out just like I thought it was going to turn. Clayton Cross stayed with the guy. Jose opened it up. Jose, he exploded, man. He really won the race for us, really. And so all I had to do is hold on a little bit. And so I was able to hold on and get a little bit more. And then Bob Harris was kind of excited because he didn't want the boys to think they caught him and run him down. And we won. So Wilma Rudolph came over to me after it was over. I'll never forget this. Wilma said, I see what happened there. She said, I knew y'all could swim. Y'all just needed a coach who understood who you were. And of course, this was an Olympian talking to us. And so she gave us tickets to go downtown to see the basketball game. Tennessee State were playing the University of Hawaii. It was a big deal then. This was 1962. December 1960. It was a big deal because you had the all black school there playing an integrated school in Nashville. So they she gave us the tickets to the game and stuff. So I asked the coach. The coach was upset because I had contravened his orders. Well, to make a long story short, it spiraled out of control, and I was assaulted by the coach. I was taken off the team, and I had to drive. We had to go back to Morehouse. I mean, I didn't say a word. And then the next day at swimming team practice, I went down and cleaned out my locker. And all them guys, I ain't say nothing to them. All them guys cleaned out their locker and came up to my room and said, Coop, what are we going to do now? I said, I don't know what y'all going to do, blah, blah. Well, we can't swim. We can't swim like that. See, what happened is they had understood the direct democratic thing, which I later understood. And then they took it upon themselves to exact a certain amount of justice. And that was the last, my swim career was over. So I never did go back, but I did. I finished in 3.5 years, so they didn't kick me out of the school or nothing. That's when I understood the direct democracy stuff. It wasn't really taught to me or taught to anybody. And I talked to my teammates now about that. Some of them understood it. Some of them say, well, we should have done what the coach said. You know, that was the 1 year after the sit-in. And I'm thinking that was a greater turning point than the sit-ins actually were.
You're listening to a portion of a conversation with Dr. Modibo Kadali, and he's a social ecologist, academic, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, Black Power, and Pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. And this is a part four of a four-part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, maroonage, Black anarchism, and atheism with Dr. Modibo Kadali. The music in the background is Kurima by Chinoiso Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation with Dr. Modibo Kadali and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope.
No, that's a very interesting, and I'm glad you opened it with this narrative, because again, the idea that we can often identify the specific or the specificity of the point where we become politically conscious, as you mentioned, is really kind of hard to do, because a lot of times it's ingrained in who we are. If you could go back just a little bit and talk about being a swimmer, swimming in creeks, coming from the community that you came from, because you mentioned it, but talk a little bit more about your community that you came from, that you were raised in. Yeah.
Well, the community was called Crossroads, but the little white merchant group of people, which the Jim Crow laws kind of helped develop, they lived in a little town around the sawmill. The sawmill was the economic center of the community. And Riceboro is where the post office was and where the white merchants were, you know, had the little grocery store. There was no big grocery stores or anything then, but Black people had little shops in the periphery where they sold, candy and soft drinks and some supplies that Black people need. But the principal grocery stores were owned by the people who owned the sawmill. One turning point event took place. I was in high school with my brother, who's 1 year, 2 years older than me. He was in high school too, but he had a paper route. And my brother was older than me, and he went to the sawmill one day to collect, for his paper route. I was at home. He rode up, and he had been assaulted. I mean, his nose was bleeding and, his face was all, it was a mess. And so he was so angry, I couldn't get him to talk. So my father was down in the field. My father was the principal of school. And he had to have some kind of diplomacy with the white people in the town. And they had to have some diplomacy with him too, really. I went down the field and told him what happened. My father came up to him and said, what happened? What happened? So he tried to tell him that this white guy beat him up, knocked him off the porch and all. And I said, what were you doing? He said, I was just trying to collect. So what my father did, and I was in the car and observing all of this, my brother had gone into the closet and got my father's gun. And he was on his bicycle going back to town, and he was going to find this guy and kill him. That was his idea. We were able to intervened and got him to cool down and get in the back of the car. My father took the gun from him. Told him, my gun. What are you doing with my gun? You know? So I'm observing all of this stuff. So my father go to the store where the owner of the sawmill was. He owned the store too. His name was C.B. Jones. He was also a descendant. He was also a descendant of the rice aristocracy. His great-grandfather had owned some plantations too. So he, you know, it was a continuation of what would have been happening in the country all the time. So my father went in there, asked to see C.B. Jones. C.B. Jones came out there and said, my father, there's another little maneuver too that I don't know if you know about this, but the black men never wanted to be called boy or by their first name. So they didn't tell these white people what their first name was. They gave them their first initials. That's why, so by calling him C.B. Jones, he didn't have to call him Mr. Jones. By him calling E.B. Cooper, he didn't have to call him Evans. So that was an equalizing kind of thing going on culturally there. You know, and all these little subtle things was registering in this community as to who I was. My father also was one of the founders of the NAACP. But people already had the right to vote. So it wasn't like, the contradiction wasn't as sharp in this coastal community as it was upstate where he came from, where my mother came from. My mother came from Jefferson County, which is up there where they did cotton. We didn't do no cotton. Was no cotton down here. I never seen no damn cotton until I went up Central Georgia. But anyway, so my brother, me, I'm just, you know, looking around, you know what I mean? And I guess I must have been about 12 years old, 11, 12 years old. C.B. Jones came out and said, you see, I still call him C.B. Jones. That's who he was to me. He wasn't no Mr. Jones, C.B. Jones. And he came out and said, Professor E.B., what's going on? He said, well, we have a little, my father was diplomatic. He said, we have a little misunderstanding here. My boy was assaulted by one of the guys who worked for you. And he was out there trying to get his money to be collected. And he had done that before at this place. What had happened was there were some white guys from up near Jessup had come down and they were related to CB, but they didn't understand what was going on in this community. This community is different from what they had up there. So what had happened was, this is the best I got from the story. My brother went up there and said he wanted to talk to CB Jones. And then so one of the guys who was visiting, he said, you don't mean CB Jones, you mean Mr. Jones, don't you? And my brother said, I don't call my daddy Mr. Daddy. Oh, that set them guys off. That set them. Oh, man. And that's when he got assaulted. So when C.B. Jones got the hang of that and got the message, he called the guys out. He says, you need to apologize to this boy. And the guy said, I ain't gonna apologize to no nigga boy. And so my father said, well, maybe if it's all right, he was negotiating. He said, all right, well, can you apologize to the professor? You know, he was a man about 35, 40 years old. You know, he was a man. He wasn't no boy. And he said, I apologize to this nigga here, but I ain't going to apologize to this little nigga's son. And T.B. Jones said, no. Who's working for who here? You know, and he made him apologize to my father. Now, he didn't allow him to apologize to my brother, but he made him apologize. And he asked my father, he says, is that all right with you? And my father said, well, I guess that'll do. And then he grabbed my brother and we went left. And he gave my brother, said, man, you got to be careful with these people around here. Yeah. But that was the kind of town we lived in.
No, that's really fascinating because, you know, this is obviously, you know, you're talking about a social context that kind of scales up, right? Yeah, you talked about being you know, downstate and then upstate, and how the different social relations become important. But again, I hope folk are gleaning from what you're saying. You're coming from a particular area of Georgia. You're coming from, an area where there's a sense of resistance and dignity.
Yeah, it comes from these people down here were Geechies, and they're descendants of the Maroons that I write about. That's who they are, you know. That's who I was, but I wasn't born down. I was born in Savannah because that's where the hospital was, but my father and mother came down here from Savannah State as teachers, and they raised their family down here. So me, my sister, and my brother, we Geechies too. So when we went upstate, we talked a little different. It's not a wholly developed language, but it's a vernacular, you know. And people used to tease us. We teased them because they talk funny to us. We talk funny to them. But the voting thing, the black people down here voted the whole time. I don't even remember not voting. Now, they couldn't run for office, but they could vote.
Yeah.
That's what made CB sensitive, because CB ran for sheriff and he wanted to support some of the black people.
So there was these instances, and there's many instances where there's this negotiation process of like there's a pushing against the social order. But then there's also an attempt to kind of maintain that order. So there's those contradictions
Where did you grow up?
By the way,
this is the early 1950s in rural coastal Georgia.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I came years later, but I wasn't even thought about it until like. So between Philadelphia, so it was very interesting because between Philadelphia, I was able to play basketball. I grew up in a time where you couldn't go to certain places unless you actually were, you had passes, you would say. Mm-hmm. I played basketball, so I was able to kind of move around to different parts of the city. And then I moved down to Richmond, Virginia. So having those stark social experiences become very important, you know, for me. And then, of course, I played basketball and then I went back to Philadelphia and then I went to D.C. So I've been, you know, in this kind of like, I guess, Mid-Atlantic area for, you know, a particular long time, but also traveling. I've been around multiple times, and my family was a transient family as well. Mm-hmm. We lived, you know, in multiple places throughout the places we kind of lived. But
let me bring this up too, because in 1952, I had a kind of a transformative experience. My mother and father were educators. My mother was a librarian. And my father, you know, principal, they enrolled in a summer program at Columbia University, and I think in 1951 or 52. So they took the whole family up there. So my brother and I stayed with my father's sister, who lived in the Bronx on Rogers Place right off Westchester, near the Interville subway station. But it was, you know, it was elevated then. It wasn't in the ground then. I mean, when you get up to the Bronx, you know, it's elevated. It's not, doesn't go underground until you go downtown a little bit. The Interville station is the next station on the, forgot the name of the line, Dye Avenue. And it goes up. The next station down was Prospect Avenue, still in the Bronx. And it went downtown. My brother and I went to New York, and so we played baseball too. We played baseball with a rubber ball that we took an axe and cut it in half so it would do stuff, you know. So these guys played with a smaller ball. These Italian guys played with a smaller ball like this, but it would do similar things so we could hit it and we could run. So we was in on the street, you know what I mean? And so then I realized that all these people, they were white guys. I mean, they were Italian, but they were white guys. And they ate different food, you know what I mean? At first, I had a pizza in one of these guys' houses, apartments. And I thought it was a pie. They invited me, you want some pizza pie? Yeah, I thought it was a sweet potato pie, man. You know, I mean, that was the limited thing. And they had the people speaking Spanish, people speaking Italian, people speaking English, they're getting along. Then they had the big market up the street Well, some of the Italian immigrants had, you know, had this, the ethnic foods and stuff there. And that experience was transformative because when I got back, I went into Riceboro and my little sister, she was about 7, 8 years old. She made the mistake of drinking some of the white water. And so one of the ladies who was the wife of the store owner, Hodges, she said, don't drink that. That's for white people. We don't believe in no race mixing around here. So I said, well, in New York, can't piss on everybody up there. She said, well, that's New York. That's them damn Yankees up there. They don't know. So, but I understood that. I began to see the difference between the South and the North. And of course, my father made sure that we stopped in Washington, D.C., saw the Lincoln Memorial, went up in the Washington Monument, went by the Supreme Court and all that kind of stuff. And we stayed in Philadelphia. We stayed in Daddy Grace's hotel. I think it's still standing now. What's that? What they all call it now?
I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big, tall hotel. Yeah. And then we went on up to the Bronx and we went into Yankee Stadium. And I knew the Yankees because that's the team that I wanted the Brooklyn Dodgers to beat up on. And, you know, Brooklyn Dodgers almost had a complete black team by 1952. Yeah. I can still name the guys. You know?
This is very fascinating because I'm also. And I definitely don't mean to speed up because what I'm really interested in how these lived experiences are filtered through as you're developing your intellectual practice and your organization practice. These things become very important because they're leading you to.
And there's another little thing that's important. My father was a reader, and he subscribed to the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Baltimore African American, the Amsterdam News, the weekly edition, of course, the Jet and the Ebony. And then when Emmett Till got killed, I remember the morning, man, when he read about it, he kicked a hole in the wall, man. He said, them crackers ain't gonna do right. And he was cussing and going on. He was enraged. My mother had to come in there and settle him down. But he was very aware. And by the way, he was a World War II veteran, even though he didn't go to Europe or to the Pacific primarily because they wanted him to stay at Fort Benning and teach the incoming black sharecropper's sons to read. So he was teaching them. So he never did get to go because he was an educated Negro who could teach them. And he was, he had the rank of a sergeant. And he said things. He said, this stuff stuck with me. He said, when they would have German prisoners of war coming to Fort Benning, if the German soldier was a officer, they required all the soldiers, black and white, to salute the German officers. And he appreciated that. And the first officer he saw in downtown Columbus, and of course he saluted him. He was a sergeant, non-commissioned. This guy was a first or second lieutenant.
You've just been listening to a conversation with Dr. Modibo Kadale, who is a social ecologist, academic, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, black power, and Pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. This was a part four of a follow-up from our last week's show, and is part four of a four-part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, Maroonage, black anarchism, and atheism with Dr. Modibo Kadale. The full part four of the four-part series with Dr. Modibo Kadale and African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope will be available on African Isles SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. African Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Yarabi by Sona Jobate. That's it for African Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Mutale. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana Hussein Alamin, looking at issues in Northern Africa and in the Middle East, particularly focused on the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the Women's Collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder, which is followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly. And that's followed by Convit La Kai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. Also, thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, January 29th. Here are some headlines. President Donald Trump's plan to freeze all federal aid has run into its first challenge, with a U.S. district judge temporarily blocking the order. The White House Budget Office ordered the freeze on federal grants and loans to target Democratic initiatives that address immigration, foreign aid, climate, DEI, and gender identity, according to a memo obtained by CNN. The order could have potentially impacted hundreds of billions of dollars in government spending and halted public programs that affect millions of Americans. It also marked the latest move by the Trump administration to exert control over federal funding, even that which has been already allocated by Congress. In related news, the Trump administration has offered federal workers the option to resign and receive pay for 8 months, a move that could significantly reduce the size of the federal workforce. In an email, his administration asked all government employees to decide by February 6 whether they want to be part of a deferred resignation program that will mean them leaving their jobs no later than the end of September. The plan immediately drew criticism from Democrats and unions representing federal workers, who said such a vast reduction in force would create chaos for Americans who rely on government services. In a statement, the head of the American Federation of Government Employees Union warned that this purging process would have, quote, vast unintended consequences that will cause chaos for the Americans who depend on a functioning federal government, close quote. In other news, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Trump's pick for Secretary of Health and Human Services, is facing questions from lawmakers at his first confirmation hearing today. Lawmakers have expressed reservations about his qualifications, past vaccine denialism, and conspiracy mongering. Kennedy contended in his opening statement that he is not anti-vaccine or anti-industry, but is rather pro-safety. Ranking Member Ron Wyden slammed Kennedy over conflicting stories about his vaccine views during questioning, pointing to past anti-vaccine comments Kennedy made on podcasts. Kennedy's hearing comes a day after his cousin, Caroline Kennedy, urged lawmakers to reject his nomination, saying he, quote, preys on the desperation of sick children, close quote. He'll likely face inquiries from Senate Republicans over his support for abortion rights, though his exact position on the key issue has apparently shifted. If confirmed, RFK Jr. could radically reshape Health and Human Services and the divisions it encompasses. And President Donald Trump has appealed his hush money conviction and has brought on a new team of attorneys to represent him as he seeks to erase the verdict that made him the first person with a criminal record to win the office. In May, a New York jury found Trump guilty on all 34 counts of falsifying